Hi, everybody, and welcome to the Cultural Studies podcast. My name is Toby Miller, and my guest today is
Lilith Mahmoud. I'm an associate professor of anthropology at the University of California, Irvine.
And Prof. Mahmoud, thank you so much for doing this. I really appreciate it. It's exciting to meet you. I know from reading your first book that you're a cat person, and I've already introduced you to the podcat, who has scurried away, thankfully, for all concerned. He's in one of those modes where he doesn't like the food I'm getting him. So I'm in this.
So he's a cat.
This proves he's. Prof, I wanted to begin by asking you about what's currently dynamizing, retarding, preoccupying, interesting you.
Yes, and thank you so much for having me on your podcast and introducing me to the amazing podcat. Besides cats, one of the things that's really been on my mind lately is the way the current politics in Italy are yet again reshaping the Mediterranean migration crisis. And I put crisis in quotes because, as you well know, it's been going on for over 25 years, and it's hard to call anything that is that chronic a crisis. But I've really been interested in how Italy figures in the migration routes that have been bringing really desperate souls, migrants, refugees from various parts of the global south, from sub-Saharan Africa, also from the east, to Europe. And of course, geographically, Italy is the first country of entry for a large portion of migrants and refugees who chance the Mediterranean in the hope of finding a better life on the other side of the sea.
Indeed, and this has such a complex history, doesn't it, Prof? Beyond the 25 years, there's Italian imperialism in Africa and elsewhere. And I guess every few months, the European Union and Italy announce some kind of new initiative, just like the French and the British do. And these things seem like they're a kind of, I don't understand them the way you do, but they seem like tortured attempts to combine xenophobia with liberal humanism.
Absolutely. I've actually been very interested in liberalism for quite some time, starting with my earlier work, as you know, the one where I outed myself as a cat lady. That was a work on Freemasons, right?
Yeah.
Freemasons, who are members of an elite secretive organization that was instrumental in the formation of Enlightenment ideals and of liberalism as a philosophy historically, a few centuries back, right? So liberalism, I think, has become more and more not really an ideology on the left or the right of the political spectrum, but almost a set of taken for granted assumptions about what morally righteous humanist politics ought to look like. And while that sounds wonderful in theory, in practice, we know that it has failed to live up to its promises of equality, of humanism for all, right? It's never actually succeeded at implementing those values of, you know, liberty, fraternity, and equality for all. So we see that playing out in contemporary politics in ways that I think are very neocolonial. I appreciate that you just brought up, right, those imperial histories, because even though the situation at hand seems radically different, because now you have movement from the south to the north, right, rather than the imperial project of Europeans going elsewhere in the world, we see those colonial relations play up very much in the kind of transnational agreements the EU continues to enter in to curtail foreign migration, for example, between Italy and Libya, right? Mm-hmm. Geographically, Libya in North Africa is the departure point for these Mediterranean voyages that refugees and migrants undertake. So for most of them, Libya is the entry point into the Mediterranean, and Italy is the first arrival point into the EU, right? So that connection, which is also a colonial one, is playing up in the present.
Prof, when I was growing up in Britain in the 1970s, there was an expression popularized among leftist immigrants from South Asia and Africa and the Caribbean, which was, we are here because you were there. And I've always thought it was one of the most poignant political slogans, and I mean slogan in a positive sense, I've ever encountered. It makes so much sense. And of course, here in Spain, there are enclaves in North Africa that are still Spanish, you know. And this also leads to all sorts of complications in terms of the Spanish imaginary of its racial formation, along with, of course, its long history of occupation by Islamic forces from North Africa, and the denial of the cultural heritage that derives from that, that is so important here. In terms of the Freemasons, if I could ask you about that book for a moment, Prof, and then we can certainly return to immigration itself. I love the way in the beginning of that book in which you describe yourself as sort of blurting out in your first encounter that led to the research, isn't that a secret society? And how could you ever do an ethnography of it all? Isn't that what all that it is? Because I really felt myself to be in your shoes as I read that, because I grew up thinking of it as a secret society, and I certainly didn't think of it as a bastion of liberalism. So I wonder if you could take us a little bit through that, and in particular, because I'd also seen it as a bastion of masculinity, the fact that you're able there to focus on women, not as entirely equal participants in masonry, but in some instances as having a great deal of significance and authority.
Absolutely. And even though I understand it might sound like totally different types of work, I think liberalism really is the golden thread that ties these projects together, right? So most of us grew up with all these mythologies about Freemasons, that if we think about them at all, we think of them as some conspiratorial secret society, right, somewhere. But if we think historically, the formation of the early lodges by the intelligentsia, by the European intelligentsia of the time, by the upper bourgeoisie, oftentimes as a form of resistance and critique against absolute monarchies, against the aristocracy, meant that Freemasons found themselves sometimes in the position of being revolutionaries, right? Think about the United States, where I'm based, and who the founding fathers were, right? And who wrote the Constitution of the United States, right? So the values that we now associate with contemporary liberal democracies were, and I hope I'm not overstating the point here, but largely they were theorized by thinkers, by philosophers, by scholars at the time who happened to gather in secret inside Masonic lodges where it was safe to discuss those controversial ideas, right? Try doing that under an absolute monarchy, right? So that was the starting point. And of course, then history takes different turns in different places. In Italy specifically, Freemasonry has been associated with the mafia, with all kinds of political scandals, corruption, histories of terrorism, particularly right-wing ones. But what is interesting about to me about liberalism is the way it's become naturalized as a fact. I'm an anthropologist by training. We study cultures and societies, right? And for me, liberalism really makes sense to think of as a cosmology, a worldview, a way that people in the global north believe that society and social values are organized. Have they ever actually been organized that way? Well, if that was the case, we wouldn't have inequality, right? We wouldn't have had centuries of colonialism and slavery under liberal regimes, right? But as an idea, it in the present, I've been really interested in how it serves to justify and mask some of the most violent, really genocidal logic. I can't even water that down, right? Genocidal logics that we see at play in the way that EU is managing Mediterranean migration.
Well, I think my first, in a sense, cultural encounter with Masonry, one of my few, was the Marriage of Figaro, because Mozart was a Mason, I think. I mean, I think probably not long before he died, he wasn't in it for very long, right? But that is about the idea that, in some sense, coming from an inverted commas, humble origins need not necessarily determine the rest of your life. And it's often regarded, I think, as a liberal opera, no? In that sense.
Absolutely. Mozart was a Mason. And more than that, it's funny that you mentioned that. I have a chapter in my book where I discuss Mozart specifically because for a lot of Freemasons, what made them decide to become Masons and join lodges was often a love for classical music or art. And Mozart was actually a gateway. In some way, to Freemasonry for enough people that I decided to talk about that in the book. So it's not quite a coincidence. And there are interesting esoteric interpretations of some of his works, especially of Figaro, if you listen to the rhythm of some of the music, it lines up almost exactly with some rituals, some Masonic rituals. So there's a lot of, again, that's the part of the esoteric that gets mythologized significantly in Freemasonry. And I think it's the part that sometimes fascinates us, right? But there's also the political side. There's the part of this project that has galvanized, right, revolutionary movements across the world in the name of independence and sovereignty and equal rights. And at the same time, as you mentioned, it continues to live with this paradox that most people are excluded and continue to be excluded from the notion of fraternity that Freemasonry built up, especially women.
So before we leave this, because I must admit I just got very dynamized by the book, could you talk about the gender issues in it? Because they are to the forefront. Because until I read your book, I honestly didn't know they were female Masons.
Until I stumbled upon my first one, I didn't know there were women Freemasons either, right? And I think that in itself says a lot that this imaginary of fraternity, right? And you're in Spain right now. So fraternity coming from Latin, right? In Romance languages, it literally means brotherhood. It does not mean sisterhood. Fraternity, fratellanza, right? Fraternité in French means brotherhood. And sometimes the gender gets lost in English, right? Where fraternity can be talked about as an abstract principle. But that abstraction of the masculine to the generic is really a slippage that lets us forget that, in fact, we are forgetting that there are women too. It doesn't encompass really women. The reality is there have been women Freemasons since the very beginning, since the early 18th century, there have been women's lodges, there have been mixed gender lodges. But of course, they're a minority. There is a whole controversy about which Masonic lodges are legitimate, which are not. It's a complex politics of mutual recognitions. But some of the dominant male-only Masonic lodges in the world would tell you that women lodges or mixed gender lodges are not legitimate, that they're not real. Vice versa, you can imagine what the mixed gender ones say about them, right? So, in this landscape, what I was interested in wasn't just simply the fact that, well, yes, there's discrimination against women. Unfortunately, that's not exactly news, right? We live in a world that is not, in fact, equal. Liberalism never, actually manifested fully its promises of equality. So in some ways, That is not a shocker. What I became more interested in is how all these educated, upper class women, most of whom were right wing, that I got to know deeply in my fieldwork research, what motivated them to pursue this lifelong path of self-cultivation in a Masonic lodge to bring about change, as opposed to, say, becoming feminists, right? Joining feminist organizing, joining some other social movement to bring about change. Why this movement for fraternity, which structurally was never really designed to contain them? And I became really interested in how they made demands of that notion of fraternity to make it stretch, to not just be a brotherhood, but to become what it promised to be, which is universal.
And there are so many things there I'd love to ask you about more. What do you think was the reason or is the reason why these women are not joining feminist organizations? Is there something about Italy, femininity, and feminism that produces a problem for these women who are clearly activists in one sense?
Absolutely. And they were very much activists. And I really want to stress this because sometimes in academia, we can become dismissive of right-wing social movements. And I think in the study of social movements, we have, for the most part, studied left-leaning ones. But the study of the right, which is something I'm very interested in, has become a bigger topic. Certainly in anthropology, but also in political science, also in general across the social sciences. So I want to stress that these women were activists, they were socially engaged, they were aware. And to your question of why wouldn't they just become feminists? Because to my eyes, they acted like feminists, they talked like feminists, they walked like feminists, but they were not. They were not. And in Italy, I think there's a clear explanation for that, which is that feminism in Italy has historically been tied to left-wing parties. So it was born within parties. It was not, feminism was not born kind of the way that in the United States it was born outside of political parties. So it would have been very difficult for someone who identified with conservative right-wing values, who came from right-wing families to subscribe to this name, right, of feminism that is so historically tied to communism, socialism, philosophies that they could not agree with.
Ismism, as John Lennon and Yoko Ono would have called it. Yes. Now, thanks
Yes.
for that, Prof. And I wonder, that also leads me to think about racial questions. And I wonder if you could help us, help me, to understand the part that racism plays in Italian and EU problems with people from North Africa and the rest of Africa, for that matter. What is, are there racial issues here that are crucial?
Yes, and I think that's one of the most evident failures of liberalism to deliver on its otherwise very compelling promises, right? How do you disagree with liberalism? Except it doesn't work. It has never worked. And in some ways, I've gone as far as to argue it was never meant to work. If we look at Freemasonry, right? Freemasonry said that it accepted anybody. Anybody could be a Freemason, except that most people did not qualify as anybody. I'd always like to draw a parallel to the United States Constitution, written by founding fathers who were, in fact, mostly Freemasons. Right? And it's we, the people, except that most of us were never counted as the people. So it wasn't an oversight. Right? That we the people could be written at a time when a lot of people were enslaved in the US. Right? It's not a surprise or a contradiction. It's literally about an imaginary of the human that did not count as human.
Right.
A whole lot of people who, because of their race or because of their gender, because of their disability, because of their class status, did not count as full-fledged human beings. And here we are in the 21st century thinking, well, that was a few hundred years ago. Things have changed, right? And they have. But what hasn't changed is a set of assumptions about the disposability of some lives. So when I look at the Mediterranean has been called the deadliest border in the world. We don't know exactly how many tens of thousands of people have drowned trying to sail to Europe over the last 25 years, right? We don't have the numbers because many drown in international waters or in Libyan waters, and even the ones who drown in Italian waters sometimes are recovered, sometimes their bodies are not recovered. So we're working with really imperfect estimates. And the fact that the systematic set of deaths of black and brown bodies in the Mediterranean is allowed to continue for so long is a form of genocide, and it's intentional. And who is perpetrating it? Liberal democracies of the EU, right? So liberalism is definitely contributing to this ongoing set of deaths that are not stopped, even though we have the knowledge and the ability to stop them.
And in specifically Italian cultural, political, economic terms, historical ones too, here we have, in a sense, the first big European empire. Even in the days before the sovereign state in its contemporary form, which has left its mark geographically, linguistically, aesthetically, and theoretically around the world, more in the so-called pre-modern era. But given that history, of which many Italians seem to be very proud, whence comes the xenophobia and the racism? Of what was it, what's been a very international set of peoples with a big diaspora, with lots of cultural exchange, and so on.
I think that's the irony that Italians had to earn their whiteness, right? Italians were not considered white when they first started emigrating to Northern Europe, to the United States. And this is a young country in global terms, right? Italians had to become white. And that whiteness was historically very tenuous. And so, what we saw was in the 1990s, when really the first noticeable waves of foreign migrants started to arrive. And by noticeable, I think in the 90s, we were talking about maybe 1% of the population at most, right? So, we're talking about very small numbers, but hyper visible. Because of the novelty of it, that's when we really saw a shift in racial discourses. There used to be a lot more open racism from the north of Italy to the south of Italy. So you had a political party like the League, which used to be called the Northern League, founded in the 90s for the sole purpose of seceding, right? Of splitting up Northern Italy from those Southerners who were always described in racial terms with the same exact slurs and attributes of Africans. And suddenly, politically, in a relatively short span of time between the late 90s and the early aughts, we saw a shift in the political discourse where Italy unified against the arrivals of foreign others. So the Northern League eventually changed its name to the League and became one of the most xenophobic, populist, right-wing parties in the country, now no longer arguing for secession, talking about one united Italy, winning votes in the South, right? Which makes you think about how short-term sometimes our memories can be when we vote for someone who, until a few years ago, was campaigning against us, right? So it's been fascinating in terms of political anthropology and kind of political studies. But the unification of Italy that started in the 19th century, right, that Gramsci wrote about, then in the 20s, that fascism continued, that television in the 60s made possible by unifying the language, I would argue it wasn't really completed until the 90s when foreign migrants arrived and suddenly all of that reservoir of racism. Hi, cat. Good timing for the cat to join our podcast. That reservoir of racism that was already there with the colonies, already there pre-World War II, and always there against internal minorities, was so easily refocused towards the very small numbers of foreign migrants who arrived.
And I'm thinking of two particular figures in this. I s studied Italian politics before you were born, Prof. And I know this sounds silly, but I did. And we put together in our course, or our professors did, Japan, West Germany as it then was, and Italy. And it was called Liberal Capitalist Democracies, right? And Italy was sort of the weird one because of the constant change of governments. Two figures stand out for me, and probably for a lot of people very ignorant of Italy, over the last 20 to 30 years. One is Silvio Berlusconi, who I still want to find some footage of him singing on boats, right, which was how he made some of his early money.
Yep.
As a cruise singer, and Giorgia Meloni. Are they symbols of something, or were they actually important in and of themselves? Oh, the
I
prof.
think, sorry.
You're frozen visually, prof. Did you hear? Are we still connected to audio?
I hear you. I don't know
Okay,
why I'm
good.
frozen.
Not to worry, because it's the sound that matters. So I wondered
Okay.
if you could explain to me why it might be that symbolically they've become such powerful figures in the imaginary of a non-expert, and where Berlusconi and Meloni stand in this unfurling history of Italian racism.
Absolutely. I think they represent two very different forms of the right. And here, as a scholar of the right, I think it's important to have precision when we talk about the right. It's not just one big conglomerate. And Berlusconi, in some ways, was the original Donald Trump. I think for those of us who are familiar with Italian politics, the election of Donald Trump was not a surprise. I won a bet in 2016. sometimes we win bets we don't necessarily wish for, but the election was not a surprise. But the history is very different because Berlusconi was a liberal right, a right based on capitalism, mass media, bigger than life claims, preposterousness. It helped that he did literally at the time own all the non-public media channels, and most of the newspapers and magazines. But that is one kind of story. And then you have now someone like Giorgia Meloni being prime minister, and that is actually a fascist history. Now we have to be careful when we talk about it because fascism is illegal in Italy. The Constitution of 1946 banned fascism. So after the war, the fascist party had to change its name because you can no longer legally have a fascist party. So with that said, she came of age within the fascist youths of the current names of the current parties, and even used the same logo, right, of the flame that she was questioned for. Some people thought she should therefore not be eligible to run because, again, constitutionally, the apology of fascism, the exaltation of fascism, anything fascist is illegal, right? But she came to power nonetheless. And so, even though she's not nominally a fascist, I think from a scholarly perspective, we can say without a doubt we have a fascist prime minister. And what has that meant? Well, one thing it's meant that I think is really interesting, it's this new connection with Libya that Italy now is in a position to negotiate with on behalf of the EU, broker EU agreements with, all having to do, of course, with migrants, right? Migrants in the Mediterranean. Am I still frozen?
Yes.
Should we do something?
I look, can you see me?
Yeah, I do.
I mean, I can see you, but you're frozen. But it's not one of those embarrassing frozen moments when your mouth's open. Do you know what I mean? Or you're blinking. So please continue. So perhaps we could, perhaps I could ask you to speak more about Libya historically and in the contemporary moment.
Sure. So a lot of people don't realize that Italy also had colonies. It came late to the colonial game in Europe because it came late as a nation state, right? Italy was only became a nation state in 1860, but it pretty quickly began its imperial project. So in Eritrea, East Africa, in Libya, for a moment, it also occupied Ethiopia just for a few years. But Libya and Eritrea really have been the two primary colonies. And in the present, Libya is in the strategic position of being the departure point, as I mentioned earlier, for most Africans coming through the Central Mediterranean route. And the EU, of course, has every interest in getting Libya to prevent people from boarding ships at its shores and coming over, right? So the EU has, with Italy as its broker,
Prof. Mahmoud, I wonder if you could tell us a little bit more about Libya, because this is clearly a very important node in Italian history, but also the contemporary moment.
thank you for bringing that up because I think a lot of people forget that Italy had colonies too. It came late to the imperial game in Europe, but that's because as a nation state, it was younger than many of the others. It only became a sovereign nation in 1860. So Italy did have colonies in East Africa, North Africa, of course, Eritrea, Libya being the primary ones. It also occupied Albania for a period of time, etc. But Libya and Eritrea both were these central nodes of Italian imperialism before World War II, right? And until World War II, since the late 19th century. In the present, it's therefore not a surprise that Italy is the broker between the EU and Libya on the question of migrants. And the EU has entered into several agreements with Libya that involve investments of hundreds of millions of euros in Libya, specifically in the Libyan Coast Guard. And, you know, it's when I say Libya, of course, we know right now the state of the country is such that there isn't necessarily a formal government. There's a couple of governments, one of which is UN backed, the other isn't, but we're essentially talking about militant groups in power that the EU and therefore Italy are negotiating with. And the problem with that, of course, is that when Libya prevents migrants or refugees refugees from crossing the Mediterranean, what happens in Libya, which we now well know, goes against the Geneva Convention, goes against human rights law, international law, and we have torture, we have imprisonment, we even have slavery. I think it was CNN that officially broke the news that there were slave auctions going on in Libya, that migrants were sold into slavery, something that, of course, in activist communities, migrant communities in Italy, we already knew because the survivors who escaped that would tell those stories. But that knowledge is now out in the open. So when the EU funds Libya to keep migrants and refugees from crossing, we know that what the EU is paying for is an outsourcing of policing methods that would be illegal in the EU itself. And a big part of that deal, of course, is oil and gas. Part of the investment, right, is that Italy specifically, Eni, which is a major energy company that is an Italian company, now owns significant shares of Libyan oil. And we know that with the war in the Ukraine, and therefore the gas supplies from Russia, we have seen utility costs skyrocket just last year and the year before all over Europe, right? Regular people couldn't afford to pay their gas bills. So here's this different source of energy, which is Libya, and a big currency, a bargaining chip in that energy trade is migrants themselves, right? They become the currency that Libya can unleash towards Europe whenever the deal they're getting is not favorable, and vice versa, can hold back in what we now know are conditions that completely violate human rights and international law when the EU pays up.
And Prof, one of the things that I've always found puzzling about neoclassical economics, classical liberalism, and neoliberalism is that these people favor open markets except in one area, which is free labor. They always want to be nationalistic and protectionist when it comes to the free movement of people. As you say, this becomes a bargaining chip in the energy, natural resources, markets and politics always, but in a particularly unpleasant way at the moment. What's your take on the free movement of labor? I mean, what would be your policy recipe for what's going on?
I think the free movement of people that is one of the hallmarks of liberalism always and only applied to some people. So the idea of the EU, right before it was a union, it was the European Community, right? It was started after World War II as a way to get past all of the differences among what are now member states, right? These are countries, France, Germany, Italy, that have always been at war with each other. And after World War II, they came together and decided to create this imaginary that went beyond the national, to imagine the free movement of goods, of services, of people across the European Union. And it's a liberal dream. But the only way that liberal dream was actualized was by then creating really stronger boundaries around the EU as a whole, which is why some people refer to the EU as a fortress with plenty of freedom within it, right? But inaccessible from the outside. And even that eventually wasn't good enough. We've now had Brexit, right? Leaving the EU in part because of questions of foreign migration. And you, of course, might be even more familiar since you live in Europe with the various kinds of motivations, populist sentiments, xenophobic sentiments, economic precarity that in Britain coalesced for the leave vote, right? So we have, on the one hand, this liberal imaginary of mobility, of cosmopolitanism, being a world traveler, right, holding multiple passports. And that just is not the reality of the vast majority of the people on this planet, right? It's only the reality for some of us, but not for all the desperate souls who do not have any legal way of finding a better life in Europe. And I really want to stress that there is no legal way to do so, right? Why would anyone in their right mind chance their life on a makeshift boat, on a raft on the Mediterranean Sea, chance their own life, chance their kids' lives? Why would anyone do that if they had any other viable option, knowing that the odds are against you, knowing that death is likely? Right. So the fact that there is no legal path is something that many activist organizations have called for a long time, right? You asked me what would a different imaginary look like? Well, it would look like getting your asylum application processed at the embassy. It would look like getting a visa so you can board a plane and you can fly safely to destination. And we don't have to stretch our imagination to think of a different world. We just have to look at what has been done in the EU for Ukrainian refugees, right? What has been done for Syrian refugees in 2015? It's not that the EU hasn't been capable of providing safe pathways for refugees to find safety and be welcomed. It just hasn't done so for Black refugees from the global south. It hasn't done so for brown refugees from the global south.
And that leads me to ask you, pardon me, gosh, if it's not a technological problem, it's a verbal one, right? I might have to make myself another cup of tea while we're speaking, Prof.
Absolutely.
You're on water, much more sensible. I assume that's not vodka or gin. I assume that is,
It's
the dihydrous oxide is in
it's
Southern
not
California.
even noon here in California, so definitely
Well, of
water.
course, Southern California water is always an issue. No, my question was about African folk in Italy, because one of the big issues, for example, in Colombia, where I used to live, is that there is an African descended population there that's very significant culturally. And in some parts of the country, quite significant numerically. But really, there isn't an African middle class or an African descended middle class because of extraordinary discrimination. So I'm wondering what the situation is for African descended or African Italians in terms of, being doctors, accountants, lawyers, politicians, and so on. Because one of the things that those of us who are not experts run into is controversies in Italy over black footballers or black models or black Miss Italy's and that sort of thing.
Yes, and this is the part that, especially over here in the United States, where I work, where I live, it's sometimes hard for people to grasp because there's definitely racism here, but it looks different. It takes different forms. In Italy, one of the big political debates right now is over the right to citizenship because Italy does not give citizenship based on birth. It's not a soil citizenship country. It's a blood country. So, ironically, you have Italian Americans who descend from Italian immigrants from sometime in the late 19th century, early 20th century. They may never have been to Italy, but they have a right to Italian citizenship. Whereas children born to immigrant parents in Italy since the 90s, people who are now young adults, for the most part, they have no right to citizenship based on birth, based on having grown up there. And there's been a political debate to create something called jus Kulture, so the right of culture, so a form of citizenship based on the idea that this is the only home you know, you're in every other way Italian except the color of your skin and your parents' origin. So there are paths to citizenship for someone who was born in Italy, grew up in Italy. When they turn 18, they have a right to apply for citizenship. But if they miss the window of opportunity, if they are 18-year-olds who don't get their act together within the time frame that they're supposed to attend to this really significant bureaucratic requirement in their life, they will absolutely get deported. They will get kicked out, and that has happened to a lot of people.
And there's an incredible irony here. The two classic forms of citizenship you mentioned, jus solis and jus sanguinis, are Latin concepts. And in English, we don't even translate them often. I mean, they're concepts that are so tightly tied to Italian heritage, including jus sanguinis. And yet there is this situation. So, given that, it must be very hard for people to join a black middle class in terms of political, economic, cultural power.
It's very hard because of the prevalence of racism, right, on the ground. It's also in some ways perhaps a little too soon to answer this question because we're only really now seeing the first generation, the first full generation, right, of people who have grown up in Italy and coming of age in Italy. When I was growing up there, it was a different time. It was, a different kind of personal family history. It was long before there were other waves of migrants. So when my experience growing up in Italy was different than the ones that we're probably now talking about, because I was in my high school of 1,500 students, I was the only one, right? There was nobody else. Who was not white, let alone black or Muslim or any other form of difference that, while still very much minoritarian now, it's at least present as part of a minority, right? I was an alien, I wasn't a minority. And I think that's the difference. So now it's really the first time that we're starting to see a more significant cohort of, young adults, people in their 20s and 30s who have lived in Italy their whole lives, right? And they're building a future for themselves. And what's that going to look like in terms of class positioning, for instance?
No, thank you, Prof, and thank you for sharing that. And your heritage is Eritrean in part. So that's, I guess, a big thing here in terms of that experience of being the only one, in inverted commas, in high school and being not just minoritized, but really the only person.
Yeah, and it's fully Eritrean. Both of my parents were from Eritrea, and the irony is that because Eritrea was an Italian colony, like in many other colonies throughout the world, the intelligentsia would be schooled in the language of the colonizers, in the schools of the colonizers. So my grandmother, who also, lived with us and raised me, my grandmother was a native speaker of Italian, right? My mother had gone to Italian schools in Eritrea, right? So these were my parents were completely fluent in Italian because of that colonial history from before, right? But someone like my grandmother, who loved reading, right, had this passion for, I think she would have liked to be a teacher had she grown up in a different world.
I think you
But
mentioned that in
she,
your book, don't you, actually?
do I think I
Yeah,
do
I
in the
think you do.
acknowledgments, because, she was so instrumental to my own passion for reading and writing, because she was born in the wrong place at the wrong time. Right? She was born in 1925 in colonial Eritrea, under the fascist regime, and there were racial laws in place, racial laws that made it illegal for Eritrean children to study beyond the fifth grade. So my grandmother had a fifth grade education, basically she could read and write. And so what she did was spend her life reading books, right, and learn everything she could by using that literacy that was the only thing this racial government had allowed her to have.
Well, Prof, I'd like to ask you one more question, if I may, and then throw to you to add anything you wish to what we've discussed. Does that sound okay as a way of concluding? And then I will try to splice the two halves of our conversation together. This may take all night, and I may be cursing the gods and goddesses as I do it, but it'll be worth it.
The Zoom gods.
The Zoom gods, exactly. Well, it's funny, isn't it? I mean, I'm old enough that I can remember when you turned on the television and you had to wait for it to warm up.
Just like a car.
Yes, and that also that world of the dial-up internet connection, that sound of that, will be a lost sound pretty soon. Prof, my last question for you before throwing to you, as I said, is to ask you about your, I think, path-breaking essay in the Annual Review of Anthropology. I really like those annual reviews about feminism and anthropology. And of course, related issues like queer theory and anthropology, and the relationship of these traditions, we can call them now, to decolonial projects. So I wondered if you could cast your mind back a couple of years to when I think that wonderful essay was published, and just share with us what is the place of feminism in anthropology, which, as you point out there, it goes back 50 years, right, at least.
Yeah, I love ARA articles as well, up until the moment when I had to write one. They are really wonderful to read because they're just these comprehensive reviews of an entire subfield. Of course, having to write that, what was really difficult about it was the constraints that they give you. I believe I was only allowed to cite something like 150 sources, which sounds like a lot until you have to address the history of feminism in anthropology. And I think it's a lot like the history of women Freemasonry, in the sense that it was always there, it's still here, it's always been here, and it somehow has always stayed in the margins. And part of how that marginalization has being affected is that some of the greatest insights of feminist anthropology have been seamlessly incorporated into the mainstream of anthropology. Things like reflexivity, the critique of insiders and outsiders in fieldwork research, the subject position of the ethnographer, they've just become absolutely mainstream. Nobody could write any kind of anthropological study without addressing those, even if they're not in any way trying to be feminists. And somehow the credit was not given as much as it should have, so that feminist anthropology can continue to appear somewhat fringe, while anthropology itself can just use the intellectual labor of feminist scholars in our field and, in some ways, pass it, right, for just anthropology, which in some ways is what you want, right? You want to become just anthropology, except that just anthropology, in the same way that just Freemasonry, just fraternity, continues to erase the contributions of a very diverse set of scholars, of people of color, of disabled scholars, of post-colonial scholars, and queer, gender non-binary women scholars as well. So it was an interesting project to think about the history of feminism, to really think about what do we do in the present with this discipline that many of us love to hate, right? I think there's so much self-critique in anthropology specifically, but perhaps in other fields as well. What do we do with that? But also, how do we make an intervention in the world, in the politics of the world that we live in, that can find a reparative way forward? I think that was my intention in writing that.
And Prof, to conclude, I wonder if there are things you'd like to add to what we've discussed.
I just want to thank you for allowing this kind of breadth of a conversation where we have spanned from Freemasonry to liberalism to colonial histories, contemporary neocolonialism, and the trade of migrants and energy. Because while it might appear disjointed, I think a soundbite is not going to do justice to the complexities of the current political moment and the histories that got us here. So I really appreciate the indulgence of understanding a bit of all of that in order to make sense, right, of the tremendous times that we live in, right? We have a fascist prime minister in power in Italy. We have no clear understanding what's going to happen in November 2024 in the United States. And I think to understand that, we can't just be focused on the present. So thank you for the breadth of the scope that you allowed our conversation to meander in.
Thank you, Prof. Mahmoud.